And I'm Christopher Purdy, pleased to welcome you all to our book edition of All Sides Weekend, something I look forward to every month. I hope my panel does as well. My guests for this program, Bill Eichenberger, whose new blog related to books is The Book Surf. He'll be telling us about that shortly. Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic and the Chatelaine of the Longest Chapter. That's Cassie Rose's blog. And Kevin Griffith, the adult of the panel, who is professor of English at Capital University and a poet. Welcome to you all, and thank you for being here. Before we get to our blogs and our books, we've had quite the obituary since in the last month since we've been together. J.D. Salinger has died. What does that mean? Who was J.D. Salinger? Who wants to speak about that and that loss? Cassie Rose.
I can say that one of the things about the loss that everybody is looking forward to is some letters coming out from him, because his friends whom he corresponded with held those letters close, because if they had let them loose, they would have incurred his wrath. That is at least what I have read. It was on Fine Books, the magazine that is going to start reissuing again. Anyway, I find that fascinating because some of the letters actually have started to come out already, and they do reveal about his life, that he lived in seclusion in New Hampshire.
Cornish, New Hampshire, yeah.
Correct.
I'm the Associated Press story that I was most interested to read was what's in Salinger's safe, and that's the real question. We don't know what it means for him to pass. I mean, it's not like he was producing fantastic literature all these years. He may have been, but we don't know. So we'll find out. And I guess he's sort of marked certain pieces to be published as is, if they're published at all, and others that he'd like an editor to take a look at first before deciding whether or not it should be published. And so I'm fascinated to find out what's going to be in the safe.
If he had been more prolific and more public in the last 60 years, because Catcher in the Rye is 1951, would we still be talking about him now after his death?
I think part
probably.
Of his but his celebrity is so much of it being a recluse. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I wonder if, you know, now if there is a safe and information is coming, you know, more literature is coming out, that it's going to take away that mystery about him. I mean, what is Salinger is the Catcher in the Rye. I mean, he is, and kind of when he went into hiding, he became what is written about into an athlete dying young, mm-hmm. you could say. He was at the pinnacle, and he left, and we're all questioning now. And so, and because of that, he's famous. He didn't have the decline if there was going to be one.
He controlled his own his own persona. How yes. we perceive him was
yes.
completely, yeah.
One of the quotes in the AP story was that he considered the publication of his works as an intrusion on his privacy, mm-hmm. which is a very strange point of view to take if you're a writer.
He would have loved the internet, I was going to say. My goodness. Yeah. Also recently deceased, Eric Segal, who that's a pop culture icon, but who was the author of Love Story and several other novels. But some of us are old enough to remember Love Story and all the 15-year-old girls in the classroom weeping over it back in 1970, and the boys read it in the car. They didn't, you know. Dare
wasn't
me.
He related to Jonathan Livingston Segal?
Don't start.
I'm sorry.
Being nice here. Don't start. Don't start.
That's a great book.
Yes, it is a great book. And I did want to ask Kevin Griffith to talk about the poet Lucille Clifton, who died last week.
I think Lucille Clifton's a real overlooked treasure in contemporary poetry. Cassie and I were just talking about contemporary poetry, how hard it is to find good poems. Lucille Clifton, a great African-American poet, her style, very much marked by simplicity, short lines. The thing I remember most about Lucille Clifton is she was a mother and she raised children. She didn't start writing till later in her life. And one of the things she talked about was her composing process, composing poems. And she said, you know, because I'm busy with my kids all day, I have to hold a poem in my head the whole day until they go to sleep. And then I rush and I write it down. And I thought, man, I can identify with that a little bit. It's just very, very difficult, but she's very prolific. And we're talking about blogs and websites. If listeners out there want to read some of her poetry, you can just go to poets.org. That's a great website where it's like an anthology of poetry on the web. You can see videos of poets reading poems, see their poems in print, and see some Lucille Clifton poetry. And there's a dedication to her on the site today.
What was the little conversation that you two were having, Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith, about poetry before we went on the air?
Well, I have had a frustrating experience with poetry recently in that, I mean, I love to read poetry. So I recently bought Chronic by D.A. Powell that just won an award of $100,000, some big poetry award. Mm-hmm. And plus it is on the list to – it's a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, mm-hmm. I believe, in poetry. So I rush out to get it, read 10 poems, and can't stand it. And I have done – and I finally was like, okay, I have done this over and over and over again with many poets. I have many in my library that I love. But how do you find a poet that resonates with you? Where is the next Lucille Clifton or Mary Oliver or Franz Wright or C.K. Williams? And so I have found that I have to, you know, pluck down the $20 and see if I like it or not, because we don't have a bookstore in town like Grolier Poetry mm-hmm. Shop, Bookshop, I think it is, in Cambridge, where you can go in and browse. Mm-hmm. Now, bringing up poets.org, I was just thinking, you probably go there, read a couple poems, and see if they work, if this poet works for you. Mm-hmm. But if you are in love with Billy Collins' work, for example, you want to find maybe other poets like that. How do you do it?
You ask Kevin Griffin.
Yeah. Well, you listen to shows like this. And also, another great website is poetryfoundation.org. That's the website of Poetry Magazine. And they also have an incredible collection of contemporary poetry. And as long as we're reviewing this new book of poetry by Tony Hoagland, Unincorporated Persons in the Late Honda Dynasty. Tony Hoagland is a very accessible poet. This is his first book in about 7 years to come out. He teaches at the University of Houston. He's very funny, very witty guy. And this book is popular. I believe it's in the top 900 in Amazon.com, which for a book of poetry is unbelievable.
Boy, that's great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'd strongly recommend, if you're looking for accessible poetry, funny, human poetry, that you can read Tony Hoagland. He has a new one out.
Tell me the title again.
Unincorporated Persons in the Late Honda Dynasty.
And I want to also talk to Bill Eichenberger a bit, because when we were last together, you were starting your blog. Now it's up, and now you're working on it. It's called The Book Surf. Tell me about how that's going.
Well, it's been the most fun I've had in about a year, is putting this together and getting back in touch with authors and being able to talk to editors and translators and authors of books. And I'm so trying to get enough up there to keep people coming back, but it's been really a blast to work on.
What's on there now, and what are you planning? What's in your head? What's coming up?
The most recent Q&A that I did is with the editor of the Library of America's John Marshall writings, the first or at least the longest standing Chief Justice of the United States from 1801 to 1835. Which, and I said on my Facebook page, you know, it's really interesting, and I'm not, you know, really, it's, I know it's the Chief Justice and blah, 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 but the historian, Charles Hobson, who talks about Marshall, gets into some of the anecdotes that really humanize Marshall, and then Marshall's writing is very direct and clear. He thought that that good writing was all about clarity and precision, and that the reader should never have to guess at what your meaning is, that should always be the first and foremost. And so even though 200 years have gone by, he's still very accessible. There's a wonderful story, though, if I will tell an anecdote that Charles Hobson passed along, was that that Marshall liked to do his own shopping in the market in Virginia, where he lived, in Richmond. And he was there one day, and he would you would usually – typically, if you were wealthy or well-to-do, you'd have a servant follow behind you, and you'd pick something, and then the servant would put it in a basket and carry it for you. But he never did that. He would just carry it himself. He'd stick whole chickens in his pockets and things like that. And some dandy had just gotten new to Richmond, had purchased a few things at the market and turned around and saw this scruffy guy with chickens in his pockets and said, "Can you carry this stuff for me?" And Marshall said, "Well, sure, I'd be happy to." Went through the market with him, stuffed stuff in his pockets, followed the guy home and got a 5-cent tip.
Oh, wow.
And then walked out, the guy never knowing that here's the Chief Justice of the United States.
Oh, my God.
And that was money in those days.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And Cassie Rose, give us a précis of the longest chapter, your blog.
Well, recently I did write about the poetry dilemma that I had. And I also wrote about a book coming out in April called Matterhorn. It's a, I think the title of the post is a big new Vietnam book that is coming out. What is fascinating about this is the story behind it. It is 700 pages long, and it took this author, Carl Marlantes, 30 years to write it.
Wow.
And what I found was interesting is at the same time I was reading in the New York Times an article about soldiers who are writing about Iraq and Afghanistan and their memoirs. And Tim O'Brien was quoted, who is a novelist and from the Vietnam days. And he said it takes longer for fiction to come from soldiers out of wars because it takes them longer to understand internally what happened. So here we have this book coming out after 30 years of writing by an ex-Marine who has won many medals.
That's fascinating to me because I know maybe you all too, but I'm the son of a World War II veteran. Mm-hmm. Who saw action, and he never spoke of it. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, if he would answer a direct question, but other than that, he never brought it up. He never spoke of it. And I wondered, there didn't seem to be a lot of first. There's Bill Mauldin. There are a few people, but there weren't a lot of first-person recollections of that period. So when you say that more recently soldiers are beginning to do that, that's interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
That they're
coming out with the memoirs.
That they're unlocking themselves a little bit and sharing what that must have been like.
Right. Well, and so then the fiction, which requires interpretation of what happened, then comes even later. So I'm very excited about this book. The other part of the story that's interesting, it was not picked up by agents and publishers. There was a small press called El Leon in California and that saw the merits in it, picked up the book and was getting ready to publish it, had it printed, was getting the reviews out. And they also had sent a few copies to Barnes & Noble staff, and they got word to the New York publishers and said, you need to look at this book.
Now, has it been released yet?
It's coming out in April, co-published by Grove Atlantic and El Leon.
And the title is, again?
The title is Matterhorn by Carl Marlantes.
We'll look for that as well. 292-8513 is the number to call. You can also send us an email to allsides@wosu.org. One more time, 292-8513. If you want to get on the conversation about books, tell us what you're reading. Give us some recommendations. Give us a couple of pans if you want to. And we'll talk about all things literary with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. And Cassie Rose has with her the Patti Smith memoir that I want to get to that. But also, Kevin Griffith, you have the large Raymond Carver biography that's gotten a lot of press lately.
Yes, I was surprised. I received this as a gift, the Raymond Carver. It's Raymond Carver, A Writer's Life, Carol Sklenica, I believe it's pronounced. And normally I'm not one to read these tome-like biographies. I think they go into way too much detail. But I picked – this is a cliche, but I picked this up and I could not put it down. It's
Hold
a
that thought.
Fascinating
Hold
book.
Hold that thought. I want to come back with that and I want you to tell us more about who Raymond Carver was. Meanwhile, we're going to take a one-minute break. We're back here at All Sides Weekend here on WOSU.
The Informant is out on DVD and Blu-ray. On The Next Fresh Air, the film's star Matt Damon and director Steven Soderbergh talk about collaborating on this dark comedy about a rising corporate executive at Archer Daniels Midland who blows the whistle on price fixing. But he has his own secrets he's keeping from the feds. Join us.
Fresh air begins at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 26 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 33. Clouds tonight and a low of 20 degrees, a few clouds on Saturday and a slight chance of afternoon snow and then a high of 35. Clouds with a chance of a rain-snow mix on Sunday and a high of 38. All Sides Weekend continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
We're back. I'm Christopher Purdy talking about books today on All Sides Weekend with Bill Eichenberger, whose blog is The Book Surf, S-E-R-F, thebooksurf.blogspot.com. Cassie Rose, NPR and WOSU's book critic, and her blog is thelongestchapter.com. And Kevin Griffith, who is professor of English at Capital University and our poet and genius in residence. Glad to have you here. 292-8513 is the number to call. We were talking about Raymond Carver. First of all, who was Raymond Carver?
Raymond Carver is generally considered probably the greatest short story writer of the last 50 years. I mean, there might be some debate about that, but there's no doubt that he's in the top five, that's for sure. And this book is fascinating because, it, again, kind of a cliche here, it reads like a novel itself. And Carver was someone who was born to be a writer, and he was obsessed with the idea of being successful as a writer, and he was willing to pay any price for that. And the price he exacted on his family and his first wife was just incredible. He struggled hard with alcoholism. He was constantly moving from place to place, college to college, as he looked for opportunities. And the really interesting thing about this, if you are a writer or you're interested in the writing process, is how much he had to sacrifice and compromise to get his work in print. He worked a lot. He had a friend, Gordon Lish, who was an editor at Random House and also began his work at Esquire. But in terms of like their relationship, Lish would often basically insert his own writing into his stories, make massive cuts into his stories. And so there's some critical disagreement over how original his early short stories really are, especially in his first book of short stories, what we talk about when we talk about love. If you look at those and some of the best lines from those stories, she talks about how they are actually written by Gordon Lish himself.
How did that happen, though? I mean, was it because Carver just didn't have the clout to object and say you can't do that?
Well, Lish was a great opportunist and self-promoter. This is interesting as an aside. I had a little relationship with Gordon Lish for a while early in my poetry career. Gordon Lish ran a poetry or edited a poetry magazine called The Quarterly, which came out of Vintage. It was a great magazine. And he was, in my opinion, he was a great editor. I knew nothing at the time, was very young, sent him some poems, and he actually sent back an envelope with like $5 in postage in it and said, send me everything you've ever written, you know, and he'd give me his phone number, I'd call him, and he would give me advice on my poetry. Wow. That didn't last very long.
Was it good advice?
Yes. Yeah, he'd say, you know, the title of this poem is facile, that kind of thing, and change it. And I bet you that Carver went through the same thing. I'm a struggling writer. I'm going to do whatever this guy says because I want to see my work in print, you know, especially in Esquire, which at the time was paying $2,000 per short story. That's a lot of money in 1978.
But the controversy is that Raymond Carver is known. He started the minimalist trend. Uh-huh. And so the controversy is, was he the one that started, or did Gordon Lish make him into that? What is also interesting is that they have republished his first collection of stories. It's called Beginners, which is without Lish's edits. Mm-hmm. And I think that that poses a dilemma for readers, because now you have to say, well, where do you begin now with Raymond Carver? Because I grew up reading and loving Carver during the 80s when he was coming, and just loved his short stories. Well, now, if I read Beginners, do I read that and say, this is the real Carver, or is it the Carver that the Lish created?
Are the differences that profound, or can you?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes,
really?
They
quite
are.
Profound.
Kidding.
Many of the stories are like half
paragraphs.
Yes.
Created the endings.
Lish was very much into lopping off the last six pages of a story or massive. If you look at some of the earlier stories, yes, they are very sort of filled with existentialism and they just end and there's no closure to them, and some often with very violent endings.
And he did push back later. He did push back against Lish.
Oh, yes, he did. When he became more famous, he had more power, and he could say no to Lish. And
so are we assuming that his later work is unadulterated Raymond Carver?
Yes, and I think if you read the book, Carver would say that too, that I finally got to write the stories I wanted to write. And
But which Lish one is the greatest? Yeah. Is the greatest Carver?
That's right.
Well, that's the dilemma, as you said, for the reader today. That's kind of what makes things a little more dicey and interesting. We're talking about a new biography of the writer Raymond Carver by
Carol Sklenica.
And we're inviting your phone calls to All Sides Weekend, our book program, at 292-8513. And we have Chris on the line, who wants to recommend a book of poetry. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I just picked up this book from Barnes & Noble. They had one copy, and it was from 2009, called Wheeling Motel by Franz Wright, James Wright's son. And I very much enjoyed it. It's not the kind of thing where you just read, like, sort of like Donald Hall talks about popcorn poetry, and you sort of wait for that one really buttery, salty bite, and at the end you're kind of sick, and, you know, it's not like that at all. It's you know, you just read through it, and there's such, he has such a way with turning language around and using verbs that you don't think of and making up words, and it's very refreshing, I think, at least for me as a writer, to read somebody who's doing things like that. It's very interesting.
Chris, thanks for the recommendation. Kevin, can you talk? Is this something known to you? Or?
Oh, yes. I think I mentioned Wheeling Motel on this show a few months back. I think that's I love Franz Wright's work. Franz Wright is someone who's not easily accessible on a first read, but his writing is not pretentious or deliberately opaque either. I think he's struggling with complications of addiction, religion, belief in God, but he does it in an interesting way. And I'd strongly recommend Wheeling Motel. And I think he also has to deal, he's dealt a lot with the pressures of being the son of a famous poet. But, of course, he's famous in his own right. He won mm-hmm. the Pulitzer Prize a few years back for Walking to Martha's Vineyard, which is another excellent book.
Mm-hmm. Going down the line here, Cassie Rose, you've brought an intriguing title with you that just got a great review from the New York Times Book Review by Patti Smith called Just Kids. Tell us about Just Kids. Tell us about Patti Smith in case people have tuned in late.
Well, Patti Smith came out with an album, Horses, in 1975, I think it was, and Rolling Stone listed it as one of the best all-time 500, not novels, but albums of all time. And it's so Patti Smith was the singer and creator, and Robert Mapplethorpe was her companion, and he did the cover on that album to sort of place who she is. She was also an artist in her own right. Well, this is a memoir of her young years in her 20s, of going to New York City in the 60s, meeting Robert Mapplethorpe, and the two of them living together, struggling together to become artists. And what is fun about it is all of the stuff that, if you grew up during that time, were the baby boomers. So she's writing about where she was during the Kennedy assassination, or, you know, how Mapplethorpe got upset when Warhol was murdered. She writes about living in the Hotel Chelsea, where all the famous
23rd
lived.
Street. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And walking into a bar that's connected to it at the time. And there was Gray Slick with the Jefferson Airplane and Jimi Hendrix. And they were all there. Getting ready to go to Woodstock. It's not the best writing in the world in terms of memoir writing. I think what carries it is because of her fame, Mapplethorpe's, how they rose to become who they were, their connection together as companions and how they supported each other, and just all of that, you know, lush, rich happenings during the 60s and the astronauts and the Kennedys. And
so she's writing about things that some of us actually remember when we were younger, and other people, it's history mm-hmm. for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure where you are, and I'm not asking that, but what I'm saying is, did it convince you that she actually was – did her writing about it convince you that she was part of it, or she was
yes.
aware of the fact – okay.
Yes, you do feel that she's part of it. And, you know, one of it is part of the – I would say the bad writing, because she's not, you know, and some of the scenes you can tell maybe they're a little too forced, and it's because, I mean, she's just getting it down, and it's not, and all the elements are there, but it's not very polished. And that is part of what is convincing about it.
And Bill Eichenberger has Days of Reading Marcel Proust bookmarked on the table, but he's got a stack with him. So why don't you choose one of your stack, and we'll talk about that.
Well, I'll get back to that later. But okay. The one I really wanted to talk about is a little book out by a French writer named Martin Page called The Discreet Pleasures of Rejection. And the story is the story of Virgil, who comes home to his apartment in Paris to an answering machine message from a woman named Clara, who says that we can't go on. I don't love you anymore. We have to break up. Which bothers him, because he doesn't know who Claire is and why she's breaking up with him. And so it's kind of this farcical, existential. He reexamines everything in his life based on the fact that a woman he doesn't know has broken up with him. And it's very funny. I was talking to the publicist for the book and saying that We don't write books like that here in this country, but in France, that you know, one a year comes out, a little fable or a parable or a light little farce that kind of takes a flight from reality, and it's very funny. It makes fun of the advertising industry. He works for Svengali advertising, and he's very careful to point out those he's not getting people to buy anything that would be harmful to them. He's trying to encourage them to buy things they don't need. And, you know, there's things like that.
Which is what advertising is.
Yes, yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. So, but it's just really funny. And it's a very light read. You could probably read it in one sitting. And
I would think that for that book to be successful, you'd have to be really convinced that he truly has no idea who this woman is or was. Not that he's on something or he's amnesiac. He has no concept of who she is.
Absolutely.
And they succeed
so
that way?
Yes, and he starts to question his memory. He goes to a psychoanalyst and it demands to have tests taken to see if what's wrong with his brain, and so he has a CAT scan, and there's a couple of pages on the founding of the CAT scan and that kind of thing. It's all kinds of like interesting sidelights like that too. He's a hypochondriac, but he consists not a hypo it's not hypochondria. It's as an illness. It's more of a hobby. And he says that someone who's gone as long as he has without sex with the opposite sex, you know, you have to fill up that time. And he said hypochondria is a wonderful way, an exciting way to fill up the time.
Cookies
you're not
too,
having
just
sex.
So you know. Anyway, 292-8513 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. We're talking about books and cookies and other things. AllSides@WOSU.org. You can reach us by email. Bill, tell me the title of that book one
that
last time.
That is The Discreet Pleasures of Rejection by Martin Page.
Very good. And Cassie Rose is carrying around with her Alice in Wonderland. So what's that about? Why are we carrying around Alice in Wonderland?
I saw this book. It's actually called Stick Figuratively Speaking, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, because it is a revisitation of the story and illustrated with stick figures. And the illustrations are terrifically fun and evocative, and you can see much more in them than just the stick figures. And it's just a very – it's hard to describe because it's completely enjoyable and a wonderful way to revisit the story, especially with Tim Burton's movie coming out next month. And this book is coming out at the same day, March 5th, I think it is, because Tim Burton's movie is Alice in Wonderland goes back. She's 19, and she goes back to revisit her friends. So by reading this book and this – with the stick figures, you get to see the March Hare and the Mad Hatter and the Mock Turtle, and to see it as an adult. And I love Alice's and all the creatures' little side comments, because it's sort of like Mystery Science Theater. You know, she'll make some comments on the side. And so it's a great way to, as I said, to revisit this story and also to see it as an adult with what Lewis Carroll was. Some of his themes of identity and growing up and how ridiculous adults are with their rules. And I found it to be just a fun book. So if you're looking to see the movie, it's a great way to revisit it. Otherwise, it's sort of a graphic novel, you could say.
Just like Catcher in the Rye, too. That's something that's well worth rereading every 5 years, just to see where you are in your life. I think that's kind of a good bookmark. Here's a question for a cold night. Cold, crummy weather. People are cabin fevered, housebound, terrible weather. So you're putting on your jammies at night. It's 10 degrees out. What are you reading to curl up with and be cozy? Kevin Griffith.
I wanted to mention this, this book. I like to find like really books on the edge, weird stuff, beyond the pale books. And the Whetstone Library is a good place to do that. I frequent there often. But I have this great book. It's dark, grim, depressing weather. So I like to get – I have this excellent book called The Museum of Kitschy Stitches. And this is a gallery of the worst photos ever from knitting magazines in the 70s.
Who thinks of this stuff?
That's
and it
great.
Works. It is wonderful. Yeah,
it's fantastic. And every page is a laugh riot. But – of course, this is radio, but in one of these pages, you have a couple they're wearing multicolored shawls and then fake fur, I don't even what you call them, helmets. And it has great commentary on it, and it says, wouldn't you like to invite these to your party, a couple with moron ponchos? So that's fantastic. And another extremely weird book, that I'd like to curl up with, not too long, though, is this is a really weird book. I could tell you, but then you would have to be destroyed by me. That's the name of this
by
book.
By me.
Yeah,
okay.
I could tell you, but then you would have to be destroyed by me. And this is a fascinating and disturbing book. It's a guy who collects patches from classified military activities that our government has undertaken. And he collects just the patches that people wear who are affiliated with this. And these are some of the strangest things you've ever seen. You wouldn't believe how our money's being spent. But here, for instance, here's a patch that's associated with the B-2 stealth bomber. And the patch shows an alien. And it says at the top of the patch, "to serve man," which is, of course, from a Twilight Zone episode about aliens who eat humans. And then it has a Latin phrase at the bottom, which means "taste like chicken."
Okay.
Wow. So I like, you know, that livens things up.
If you want to be edgy and weird, send your children to Capital University. They're studying with Professor Kevin Griffith, the Whetstone Library. That's just great.
After you read something like Raymond Carver, too, you know.
You need a little break.
Yes,
yeah. You need a little bit of break.
Spirits.
Cassie, we need your vote for cuddling up on a cold winter night.
I would recommend Richard Bausch's new collection of short stories called Something Is Out There. Richard Bausch is known for his very rich traditional stories, the kind that have great characters and, of course, a beginning, a middle, and end. He doesn't. And the themes in the story are about relationships, parents, kids, and also between spouses. But I couldn't put this book down, and I'm not a real short story writer or reader, so I don't know what it was that drew me, except that it is the writing in it and that each story just seemed so richly done. For example, there's one story called Trophy, and it is about a group of coworkers from a car dealership that go golfing, and the owner of the dealership is always in bad luck, but he takes care of his workers. Well, long story short, there is a lie that is created to give him a hole in one with one of his shots. And that lie turns his luck around. And it is Richard Bausch's way of creating that story so you see the relationships of everyone, plus you get the beauty of the new things happening, but you also carry the weight of the guilt with these characters. So that's how he sort of richly involves these stories.
Are you sure that's a cozy book?
Actually, yes, it
is.
Okay. There's another story in there with a priest who gets very tired of listening to all the petty confessions. And he has this one boy that shows up and starts asking questions like, you know, well, the dinosaurs lived for 65 million years and we've only been around for, you know, a couple thousand. What was God doing? And questioning faith and questioning and perplexes.
That's a good story.
It is a very good story.
That I want to hear. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend. We're talking about books with Cassie Rose, Bill Eichenberger, and Kevin Griffith. We invite your calls at 292-8513. Let us know what you're reading. Meanwhile, we're going to take a little break. We're back in 90 seconds. Don't go away.
On your morning commute, get the stories behind the headlines with Morning Edition.
Leslie says the Ohio National Guardsmen helped develop infantry and combat skills of Afghan soldiers.
You know, we pretty much had to start with the basic stuff, you know, how to point and shoot a rifle, how to move in combat, the basic stuff that they need to be able to survive on the battlefield.
Start your day with the award-winning WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. 28 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today and a high of 33. Clouds overnight and a low of 20 degrees. For Saturday, clouds, a slight chance of afternoon snow and a high of 35. And then for Sunday, a rain-snow mix and a high of 38.
Support for WOSU comes from Ohio State School of Music presenting Drums Downtown 7 featuring the OSU Percussion Ensemble February 19th and 20th at 8 p.m. in the Capitol Theater at the Rife Center. More at music.osu.edu.
Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to wosu.org/email to sign up for one of WOSU's e-newsletters. And be sure to tune in tonight at 9:30 for Columbus on the Record on WOSU-TV. Mike Thompson and his panel will discuss Columbus's plowing policy, criticism of the 3C train plan, and much more. That's on Columbus on the Record tonight at 9:30 on WOSU-TV. And All Sides Weekend continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
We're back. I'm Christopher Purdy, All Sides Weekend, and our monthly discussion of books with Cassie Rose, Bill Eichenberger, and Kevin Griffith. The number's 292-8513. Put a 614 in front of that if you're calling outside our immediate listening area. AllSides at WOSU.org is our email address. I want to give Bill Eichenberger a chance for his cuddly, jammy, late-night, cold-night book favorite.
Well, I have to preface this with a little bit of a story or celebration, I should say, and that's that in the last 2 weeks, I've made a concerted effort to reclaim and repatriate 2,000 books in my library from storage into my new living quarters. And it's been like getting reintroduced to old friends. And you have to tell some of them, I'm so sorry, I haven't thought of you in 4 years. It's not that I don't love you, though. It's just that there's so many of you. But and one of the sets that I moved back into the house was Stephen R. Donaldson's Lord Fowl's Bane, but it's a trilogy about the land. It came out in 1977. I had talked about it at a party with a friend of mine when the Lord of the Rings movies were coming out, and I said, you know, I never really have read anything that even approaches the Lord of the Rings, and he had recommended these, and then actually went out and got original book club versions. The book club version came out before the actual version, and they're really kind of old 70s art, kind of cheesy. But I really have a fondness for him because he, you know, when you get a gift of a book that, you know, unexpectedly like that, it was just so wonderful. So I'm actually enjoying, even though it's not the best of writing. It might even be worse than that. but it's a good fantasy, and you get lost in the land is where it takes place. And it's an interesting story. It's a leper. He's a writer. He gets leprosy because he's from India and he comes to the States. He's a popular writer, but he gets leprosy. His wife leaves him. He's kind of becomes the unclean. And then he's whisked magically into this world of the land where his leprosy is gone and he has this unbelievable power. And he's kind of supposed to save the land from destruction from Lord Fowl. And so – but he never knows whether he's dreaming, whether he's dead or whether he's just simply unconscious, and that when the dream about the land ends, he'll wake up in a hospital bed somewhere. And so you move through there, and he's very much the anti-hero. Mm-hmm. And in that way, it is fascinating in that way.
And you mentioned it's part of a trilogy.
It is, and in fact, it's now more than a trilogy because he's added several sequels.
But a book 35 years old, he's still going.
Yes,
he is.
That's
wonderful. Okay.
Yeah, so.
And as predictably, all our calls are coming in at once. We thank everybody. We have a call from Carl. Carl has a book he wants to recommend. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I was listening. I was just online. I was trying to find 200 Years Together by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And they're not printing it in English. I do have his reader that contains several chapters, and I've read most of his work. And I kept looking, and this Simon Wiesenthal Center said that it was anti-Semitic. I saw nothing in the reader that would lead me to believe that it was. Who bans these books? I guess that's my question. Who decides what is banned?
Well, first of all, have you looked on abebooks.com to see if it's available?
I've looked everywhere.
Okay.
Duke University has a PDF file, but it doesn't say how many pages it is. I think it might be a chapter or two.
Where was this book in his output? Do you know?
It was his last.
His last book, okay.
200 Years Together.
Okay.
It's been printed in Russian and I believe French and possibly German. But it just seems like it makes me wonder what else is being banned. And I guess my question seems your guests might know, who's responsible for banning
them? Can people actually ban books now, or can they just use their influence by saying, we don't like this book? That's different,
well,
which is different from banning a book.
Well, I was going to say, how do we know that it's been banned? It's more likely, isn't it, that the publishers have decided that it wasn't something that the American public would buy. And so they didn't, you know, buy it, buy the English rights or the American rights.
You know, we were talking about last month that Saul Bellow had said that the great works of literature you take in as Catholics take in the communion wafer. But he was talking about Gogol and especially, I think, particularly Dead Souls. But he was saying that Gogol is a writer of such stature and such greatness that you can overlook his anti-Semitism. And so, I mean, someone can say that something is anti-Semitic and not be dismissing it completely out of hand as worthless. But at the same time, I don't think banned is the right word, though.
Yeah, I think also, and I think what Cassie's right, I think often it comes down to money. I mean, if the publisher says, I'm not going to make money on this, I'm not going to do it, right?
Yeah.
Kevin?
Yeah. I have a colleague at Capital who teaches a course called Banned Books. It's very popular, and of course there are many, many reasons why books get banned. You know, the range is incredible.
Well, Mark Twain used to say that he prayed that some library somewhere would ban his book, book that he published when it came out. That he
and
said
that
was
happened.
Sure to increase sales.
Yeah, that has happened with his books.
Huck Finn is still in trouble once
on
in a
some
while.
Of the reading lists,
yeah, absolutely. We have a call from Crystal who wants to tell us about what she's been reading. Hello, Crystal.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just got back from Egypt a couple weeks ago. And got to see the mummy and King Tut and visit his tomb. And during that trip, somebody recommended to me a James Patterson book, The Murder of King Tut. And it just seems real current right now.
That's in the news now, right?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
He's just – the DNA tests have come back, right?
Yeah. So it's an easy read, but it's really fascinating, and it sort of fills in a lot of gaps of the you know, questions that I had when I was there.
So it convinced you?
Well, you know, he did a lot of research. He took a departure from the kind of mysteries that he usually writes. He does the Alex Cross series of detective mysteries. And they don't really jive with what was just proven by DNA. So that's interesting. But it's just fascinating to, you know, hear about Howard Carter and what he went through. You know, it took him 30 years to find anything of any substance. And when he did, you know, he finds King Tut's tomb. So I just find that interesting. And I think it's kind of a way to escape, you know, the bad weather outside to read something like that.
Very good. Well, thank you for the recommendation.
Thank you.
Thank you. One thing I wanted to ask each of you, we'll have a little 5 or 6 minute roundtable if we can do that. We know because this program exists and because you're all here that Columbus is a good town for books. Do you think it's a good town for writers? Hmm. Kevin Griffith, you teach writers, so.
In terms of like getting an education as a writer.
Getting an education and living a life that's conducive to good writing.
I mean, Ohio State has an MFA program, and it's very good, and it's produced a lot of good writers, good fiction writers. Donald Ray Pollock comes to mind, many others, so that's a good place to start. Capital offers a creative writing major, and so we have students interested in that. And what's great is there's so many free appearances by authors and ways to meet authors. And
with the Thurber House.
Book fairs and the Thurber House. That's wonderful. The Thurber House does a great job in the summer.
They do.
If you have children, to have the Thurber writing camps are just wonderful in getting students interested. So and bookstores everywhere use books. I think it's great.
Yeah. Oh, I just agree with Kevin. No, but it's also the Ohioana Book Festival is coming up, and that's a real spotlight on Ohio, authors to do with Ohio or from Ohio.
Ultimately, and I agree too, but with all of that, ultimately before that, it really comes down to your butt in the chair, I mean, and doing the writing and having a story to tell and something to write about. And then you want to have a place to be able to go and have readers or feedback such as at the universities with professors or to go to like Ohioana.
Do you think, Cassie, that exodus that we used to see from Ohio in the Midwest to the literary centers like New York, is that slowed down or is it different now than like when Thurber would go to New York or Don Powell would go to New York and they would become, you know, darlings of the New York literary scene, but, you know, but really be from Ohio and from...
I don't think it has slowed down. And that is one point when we did the Ohioan Authors series here, almost every author left Ohio. And I remember Fred Anderley stopping me in the hall saying, why is that? And, well, it's because the publishing mecca is there. The networking is there. Mm-hmm. And a lot about getting published now is about who you know and who can, let's say, if you know an author, who can recommend you to his or her agent. And publishing is a tough and very fickle industry. Yes.
But is it being replaced by the plethora of, and I mean that in a good sense, of blogs, of self-publishing, of the internet, of the fact that, you know, you can physically be anywhere in the world if you have a modem and you have a computer, you can communicate anywhere. Is that making it easier to get recognition and to get seen, or do people not care? I mean, does the hardcore Jovanovich imprint mean what it meant 50 years ago?
I think that in some ways, having a blog and using the internet is, from what I've seen, is just another way to get publicity so that
marketing.
You can get that book in print.
Mm-hmm.
The goal is still to get a book in print.
Okay.
Have a book that's in print that's a bestseller. And a lot of people now, you have to have a blog. You have to have your website, that kind of thing,
right,
to keep and your Facebook page to have that buildup of readers. But the ultimate goal is still to
have
the
something
book.
You can hold
yeah.
in your hand that a
yeah.
publisher can market and sell and distribute.
That, yeah.
That's a big part of it as well.
The other thing I'd say about your question, why do the writers move to New York and the East Coast, Boston, is that this is something that some people have to struggle with, is that when you choose to stay in the Midwest or in Ohio, you're often labeled a regional writer,
mm-hmm.
or he's an Ohio poet, or he's an Ohio mm-hmm. writer because he lives in Ohio. And that's, I think that's why no one ever says, well, he's a Boston writer.
Well, it didn't hurt Flannery O'Connor in the long run to be from the South.
Well, the South, I think, is different.
Yeah, maybe
Faulkner,
because you have Faulkner.
And
you always see. We have Jerome on the line. Jerome wants to follow up a discussion. I remember this we had last time about Jewish authors. Hello, Jerome.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I got two for you.
Okay.
Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.
Okay.
Bill Eichenberg is giving me no. He's not
no,
giving me. Not
giving me.
Okay. All right. Talk about them a little bit. Tell us who they are. Sell me.
They wrote Superman.
Oh, okay. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Okay, well, duh. All right.
Yeah, that's right.
They were, in Cleveland. And 1932. Let's see, in 38.
So when you say they did Superman, you mean they actually invented the character Superman.
Right.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
They drew the comic strip. I think he began as a comic book figure, did he not?
Mm-hmm.
Superman? Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Steve Fink from OSU was giving a two-part lecture at Congregation Beth Tikva a couple weeks ago about Jews and graphic novels and comic books. And he also mentioned, and I couldn't find it in my notes, one woman from Ohio who went to Israel, joined the army there, and came back and eventually wrote sort of an autobiographical graphic novel about her experiences. Hmm. She's not living in Ohio anymore. But I just thought I'd mention that to you.
Thank you, Jerome. Thank you for your call. 292-8513.
I was going to say, Linda Hanks from the Ohioana Library emailed me after our discussion, said R.L. Stein.
Arl Stein, of course,
right.
Yes.
And I brought in a book. I remember, Jerome, from our last conversation. This is a book I had been wanting to mention even before he called a long time ago by an author, David Gelertner. And he's an interesting guy. He teaches computer science at Yale. And he's a Renaissance man. He's written various books about history, about the World Fair, about computer science, cloud computing. This book that he just wrote is called Judaism, A Way of Being. And it's interesting, he's an artist as well. But Gerlintner is a fascinating guy because he was the target of the Unabomber in 1993.
Oh, my goodness.
He survived a Unabomber attack.
Wow.
And he's written a biography about that. And he is an incredibly intelligent man. After reading this book, Judaism, A Way of Being, he integrates Shakespeare, philosophy, 20th century philosophy, computer science, art, all into understanding a religion. I think he's one of the true, just great intellectuals out there, and he teaches at Yale, and I've been real interested in his work. He has a lot of interesting things to say, too, about the future of literacy and writing. since he is a computer science professor.
You brought one more book, too, you wanted to talk about. Yes.
Shifting Gears. This is a good book, again, for a cold winter's night. Steve Hamilton, The Lock Artist. This is a thriller. But if you liked Jonathan Lethem's Motherless Brooklyn, this is in the same vein.
I just finished that at your recommendation.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Lock Artist, it's a great novel. You can race through it. And it's about a teenage boy who had a trauma as a child, so he can't speak. He's mute. And he also has the ability to crack safes. And so, of course, he is immediately sort of enslaved, I guess you would call it, by the mob. And used, and there's no way he can get out except at the end. He does eventually slip out the grasp. But Steve Hamilton, a great writer. I didn't know anything about him. And he normally writes just a private detective series, but this is a little straying from that for him. It's called The Lock Artist, Steve Hamilton, an excellent book, a great read. He's a great writer. I just had a great time reading it. Couldn't put it down.
Another writer that last time you were all here, two or three of you recommended was Joshua Ferris. And I'm in the process of his second novel right now.
The Unnamed.
I'm finding it a little bit – we come to the end. Something like
We come to the end. That was his first one.
His first one. That's right. Yes. The Unnamed I just got. But I'm finding it a little bit slow going. Talk to me about Joshua Ferris.
The first one you're finding slow going?
Yes. About the advertising
about
agency.
About the advertising agency. Yeah. I thought it was hilarious because he really does a spin on the whole getting downsized and how people go crazy and, you know, run up and down the halls and trick each other, trick themselves. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's more fitting for someone who has, you know, been through that or is, you know. So maybe it doesn't resonate with you. His second one is The Unnamed.
Right.
It's
brand new, isn't it?
It's brand new, and it's still got the little – he's kind of got a little off. That's about him. The best way to do
it. In what way?
He was dropped on his head as a small child.
Tell me about a little off.
Well, it's because this one is about a man who just starts walking. He impulsively walks and he can't stop it. And his feet just go and go and go. And it's in the middle of winter until he passes out, falls asleep, wakes up, calls his wife to come get him. Well, he's a high-powered trial lawyer, and it gets him into trouble when he starts walking out of the law office, and he's also trying a big case. Well, in the beginning, you think it's very funny, but as it goes along, you begin to realize he's doing commentary on a health condition and what happens when a successful life is changed because of an uncontrolled health condition that nobody knows anything about. So he then takes you down this path of you start to wonder what's going to happen to the family, and he's just wandering at this point across the United States. But you have to suspend belief. You have to go into the craziness.
You have to buy into it. Yeah.
You have to buy into it and go into his world. And if you do that, then he's incredibly talented at what he's doing.
And you have a podcast of this at wosu.org/podcast.
Yes.
Joshua Ferris's latest book.
Yes.
He might be somebody just strange enough for you to interview, Bill Eichenberger, for your blog, The Book Surf.
Right, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm taking notes.
We've got 2 minutes left to the program, so I want each of you to have famous last recommendations, words, or whatever, starting with Kevin Griffith.
Well, I just got into it, but I've been looking forward to this, the new book from Henning Mankell. One of my favorite detective fiction writers, Swedish author. It's called The Man from Beijing, and I've just started it, and it's
Is it
great.
A mystery?
Yes, it is a mystery.
Because he had gotten off of writing mysteries, and my father didn't care for his fiction.
That's right. He's Italian Shoes came out before this. That was one of his works of fiction. His fiction's not as good as his mystery. He's a mystery writer.
Yeah.
I love his style, and there was an interview with him on NPR, and he says he's getting ready to release another Kurt Wallander book.
Those are the great books, yeah.
Cassie Rose's blog is thelongestchapter.com. You have a very quick last word for us?
Yes, I would recommend Blame by Michelle Hunnevin. It is one of the finalists for the National Book Critics Circle Award. It is a very good novel, let's say, kind of got a little bit of mystery to it.
Okay. And Bill Eichenberger, the book surf at blogspot.com. Talk to me.
I would read anything in Penguin's Great Ideas series. They're very short books, nonfiction, and the one I'm reading right now is Days of Reading, Marcel Proust's discussion about his reading life.
Thank you all. Thank you, Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News. Thank you to Amy Jurevich, our producer. This is All Sides Weekend.